In context, maybe in the context of the cyclic universe, where some of the questions that we're asking in early universe cosmology get qualitatively rather different answer. And this is based on work that I've been doing with Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok, and I'll touch on some work in progress with Adam Brown and Matt Johnson. So there's two key features of the cyclic universe which I think help to make it a predictive theory. And the first is that the phase during which the universe becomes smooth and flat occurs when the Hubble rate is low compared to the other phases of evolution. So in particular, compared to the phase of evolution where ordinary observers are produced. And the second feature is that there is an instability in the model which ends up playing the role of a selection principle. So selecting out certain types of universes compared to others. And so I'm going to first give you a brief overview of the cyclic model for those people who are not familiar with it. I'm going to take the point of view that this is based on the original picture of Hojawa-Witten theory or heterotic M theory, where our universe is seen as a brain world and there is an internal Calabi-Yau manifold, and there's an extra dimension which is transverse to the brains and which is larger than the Calabi-Yau space by an order of magnitude or so. In this, for most of the evolution, the brains are at roughly fixed distance, but the idea is that close to the Big Bang, these brains can be dynamical, and in fact, the Big Bang in this model is identified with the collision of these boundary brains. From the four-dimensional effective field theory point of view, one can describe the distance between the brains and later on also the volume of the Calabi-Yau space as a scalar field, and the model rests on having a conjectured potential for this distance between the brains or for both of these fields, and this potential is sketched out here in at the bottom. So in the model, we would be entering the dark energy phase on the right with a scalar field slowly rolling towards the left in a kind of quintessence type of dark energy. And then, in the far future, the dark energy will start to decay. The scalar field rolls down the potential. Eventually, the potential turns negative, and the universe starts to contract again. Then the ekprotic phase is when the scalar field rolls down a steep part of the potential, steep and negative. And during that phase, the universe is is made flatter. So this ekprotic matter dominates over all other forms of matter, in particular anisotropies. So even though the universe is contracting, it's not amplifying anisotropic curvature. During that phase, also the perturbations are created in a manner quite similar to inflation. So in the sense that modes are amplified which exit the horizon. Now, then as the scalar field, the potential becomes unimportant and the scalar field shoots off towards minus infinity on the left. And that would be that's when the two brains collide. Okay, after the collision, the scalar field comes back onto the plateau of dark energy where at the brain collision, some radiation and matter are produced. And so when the scalar field comes back onto the plateau, it gets Hubble damped by the presence of radiation and so stays there for a while. And then that's the ordinary phases of radiation and matter domination, and then eventually the scalar field slowly starts rolling back to the left again. And then in this model, the scalar field can keep doing that. Okay, so here's a brief overview of the scales. There's nothing so particular about these numbers, except that I'd just like to point out that the Hubble rate over the course of one entire cycle comes back to its original value. So in that sense, the model is cyclic, whereas the scale factor, which is not really a locally measurable quantity, grows by a very large amount over the course of each cycle. That has important consequences. So in particular, the scale factor grows during the ordinary radiation and matter phases and, of course, during the dark energy phase. But during the ekprotic contracting phase, the total contraction is very small and negligible in the total picture. And then the time a cycle takes is roughly given by the time spent in the dark energy phase. So the rate of expansion during the dark energy phase is one eFold per 10 billion years, and so a cycle will roughly last the number of e-folds of dark energy expansion times 10 billion years. Okay, so how can this help in issues like the measure problem? I think one heuristic way one can see that this might give quite different results from what we're used to in eternal inflation is that the phase when radiation and matter is dominates, then the Hubble rate is very large and decreases. And then during the phase where the universe spends most of its time, which is the dark energy phase, the Hubble rate is at its lowest. So it's at the current value of expansion. And so in other words, there is no amplification of large and rare fluctuations. If you have a fluctuation in the dark energy phase, it just means that that region of the universe will have a cycle that lasts a little bit longer or shorter. But it doesn't strongly affect the overall evolution. So also, one can imagine, if one imagines that the number of cycles, time is going up in this picture, so if you imagine the number of cycles goes up all the way to infinity, so you have an infinite number of cycles, you produce infinite numbers of observers, so you will need some kind of measure to regulate these infinities, then if you imagine using a geometric cutoff by drawing a cutoff surface on this graph, then the vast majority of observers are not right next to this cutoff. So in eternal inflation, because of the exponential expansion and because you're always the vast majority of observers in the whole space-time are right next to the cutoff, and you're extremely sensitive to precisely how you draw the cutoff. Whereas here, the observers you produce always produced a little earlier. And so you don't have an obvious measure problem in that sense. Also, there is no Boltzmann-Brain problem because the rate at which you produce ordinary observers is extremely fast, is a lot faster than the rate at which you produce Boltzmann brains. This is, again, due to the fact that the dark energy phase here is at a very small value of the cosmological constant. So the rate of producing a Boltzmann brain is roughly something like every e to the 10 to the 60 years, whereas a typical cycle here will last only a trillion years and will produce billions of observers. Now, you can even take this a little further by just looking at these toy models. If you imagine that, you could imagine that as you take the brains further and further apart, the potential has to come back down to zero. If that's the case, then you can imagine that there is a part of the potential on the right where it is sufficiently flat for eternal inflation to occur. Excuse me. In fact, you can take this even further and imagine that there's a little dip in the potential so that you actually get false vacuum eternal inflation. Now, then, if you imagine that no higher lambda vacua are accessible, then even in a model like this, you don't have an obvious measure problem. Because as long as the rate of tunneling out of this vacuum is faster than the rate of producing Boltzmann brains, and that is easy to arrange. So you can, in this model, you have a phase of eternal inflation, and yet you don't run into an obvious measure problem because the Hubble rate is at its lowest during the phase of eternal inflation, and it's much higher when you produce ordinary observers. Yes? Sure. So, yes? That's right. But I just don't think that this is going to be very sensitive to how you choose that measure in this case. Right. So I think the reason for that is that because of the high Hubble rate during the phase of eternal inflation. So I think there is hope that in this case, I don't have precise quantitative results at this point, but I think there is a hope that it's not going to be the same issue here. So in a sense, this model becomes quite reminiscent of the Sitter equilibrium picture that Andy Alwesh is going to talk about tomorrow, I think, where you could say that you spend most of your time in the dark energy phase, and occasionally you have a process that needs to be sufficiently fast and where you produce ordinary observers and therefore beat the rate of producing Boltzmann brains. So in this case, that phase of producing ordinary observers would be a phase of ekpyrotic evolution. So the second topic that I want to talk about is this issue of instability and selection. And there's two components to this. One is that in the multi-field ekpyrotic model, the potential has an instability. And this has the consequence of sort of diversifying the various evolutions you can have. And then a second component of this is the Big Bang itself, which is modeled by a collision of brains. And this brain collision acts to select some of these histories, some of these various types of evolution. So in the first part, you diversify. In the second part, you select then certain ones of these possible trajectories. So this is a sketch of a two-field ekpyrotic potential. So if you imagine having two scalar fields which both obtain a steep negative potential, then it's more natural to analyze this in a rotated set of coordinates where the sigma coordinates runs along a ridge in the potential and the S coordinate that is transverse to it actually fields an unstable tachyonic potential. Now, it turns out that if you calculate the perturbations you produce in this model, then in the direction that goes along the ridge, which is the adiabatic direction, you actually make blue perturbations, whereas in the transverse direction, you make scale-invariant perturbations. And so the way in which you produce scale-invariant curvature perturbations is by a curvaton-type mechanism, where you need to convert these scale-invariant isocurvature perturbations into curvature perturbations by a bending of the trajectory in field space. And there's two ways that are known on how this can happen in this model. The first is just because of the instability in the potential, the trajectory can just roll off on one side. As soon as it does that, you convert these scale-invariant isocurvature perturbations into scale-invariant curvature perturbations. A second, and this is characterized by certain values of the non-Gaussianity parameters. For example, here I've shown FNL and GNL, which are the local non-Gaussianity parameters for the 3 and 4 point function. Now, a second possibility is that the trajectory actually stays on the ridge all the way down. So this will only be true for a very small set of initial conditions. You stay all the way down, and then later in the kinetic phase, when the potential becomes unimportant, that the trajectory turns then and then converts these isocurvature into curvature perturbations. This also occurs automatically in the models that I'm considering, and I will describe that in a minute. So these trajectories that make it all the way down are characterized actually by different values of the non-Gaussianity parameters. So there's a correlation between what non-Gaussianity you get and which type of conversion mechanism you have. Furthermore, the further down you go, the potential, the larger you make the amplitude of these perturbations. So in these models, the perturbations get amplified as long as while you roll down this potential, while you're in this ekpyrotic phase. And as soon as you have the turn in the trajectory, then whatever value of the amplitude you have at that time gets imprinted into the curvature perturbation. So if you roll down further before you turn, you make a larger delta rho over rho, which I'm also denoting by Q here. Okay, so the next stage after this, the ekpyrotic phase happens before the collision of the brains, and the next stage in the evolution is when the brains collide. Now, here there are two possibilities. So those trajectories which undergo a long period of ekpyrosis, in those regions the universe becomes extremely flat. Curvature anisotropies become extremely suppressed, and this corresponds to the brains becoming very flat and parallel in the approach to the collision. Now, for those situations, the semi-classical calculations have been made of for example, of how much particle production you get at this collision of the brains. And in fact, the states that are most relevant at that point are membranes that stretch between these two boundary brains. Those are the states that become the lightest states as the brains approach each other. And these calculations show that, first of all, the equations of motion of these stretched brains are regular at the collision itself, and also that the amount of particle production you get depends on the collision velocity. And so for small velocities, you get a small amount of particle production. And so the conjecture here is that those regions will make it through this bond. Okay, on the other hand, if you consider regions where the ekparotic phase ends prematurely, then those regions will still are still in a contracting phase, so now you will develop large anisotropies, you get chaotic mixed master behavior, and a very anisotropic crunch, and a lot of particle production at the crunch, and so I will conjecture that those regions, because you have so much particle production, they recollapse immediately and stay in collapse, in the gravitationally collapsed state. Okay, so if we look at this in the sort of field scalar field space, moduli space, there would be an ekparotic potential here on the right, and I'm drawing the trajectory that makes it all the way along the ridge, which is one of the least likely trajectories, and then this there's a bending that occurs because there's an effective repulsive potential in this moduli space. Because the Calabi-Yau volume at positive values of this phi 2 field would turn out to be negative in this from the higher dimension point of view. And this corresponds to the negative tension brain coming close to a space-time singularity. And because it has a negative tension, it actually gets repelled by that. And so you have an effective repulse. You don't actually go into that region. So the trajectory bounces back, and then for one particular such trajectory, the collision will correspond to a Milne universe colliding in 11 dimensions. Okay, so this is the trajectory that is least likely to occur, but it also is the one that produces the most structure because it's the one that goes furthest down this ekparotic potential. Now, then you can have trajectories that bend earlier, and these, if you go into the crunch at different angles in this picture, this corresponds to the crunch itself being a Kasner-type crunch in 11 dimensions. But still, Kasner, which in a technical sense is still close to Milne. And for those crunches, the same criteria, for example, have been studied, namely that the equations of motion of stretched membranes are regular and that the particle production is finite and proportional to the collision velocity to some power. All this is exactly the same as for the Milne crunch. So these seem to be equally fine at the semi-classical level. So I'm going to take these semi-classical results seriously here and just explore their consequences. So these seem to be fine too. Now, if the trajectories bend much further up the potential, it seems likely they will not make it through the crunch make it through the bounce and that these will crunch and collapse. So the picture would be that you have all kinds that this ekparotic phase with its instability creates all kinds of possible field configurations, some more likely than others. And then those that end up being extremely flat in the approach to the crunch actually make it through the crunch and get amplified hugely during the next phase of expansion. So each of these crunches is followed by a phase of radiation and matter and dark energy expansion during which these regions get hugely amplified. And then during the subsequent ekparotic phase, the contraction is again very small. So even though we're losing lots of trajectories, lots of regions of space because of this selection effect, as long as there is enough expansion during each cycle, the universe still grows, or the habitable regions in the universe still grow from cycle to cycle. And so that's why we describe this global structure as a kind of Phoenix universe, because at the end of each cycle, most of the universe goes into ashes, but one tiny seed or some tiny seeds survive and then grow into the next large habitable region of the universe. But so one condition for this to work is that the dark energy phase has to be long enough. And depending on the details of the model of what you assume about the potential, this comes out as requiring that the dark energy phase has to last between about 50 and 60 e-folds. And that means that each cycle lasts about at least 500 or 600 billion years. So dark energy plays a really essential role in this model in sort of amplifying the regions that have been selected at the crunch. So if you take a spatial slice at any given moment, there will be regions with different values of Q, with different amounts of structure, and the correspondingly different values for non-Gaussianity parameters. And then there will also be regions that are just gravitationally collapsed and that have been, that we got rid of. So there's a kind of dissipation in the model, which I think helps in making it predictive. Now, it turns out that the amount of structure that you produce in these regions where you make it all the way down the ekpyrotic phase is much larger than all the structure you produce in all the other regions combined. Okay, so let me just give you one other example of how this effect of selection can be useful in understanding the values of certain cosmological parameters. And so what I'm going to focus on here is the amplitude of perturbations. So the amplitude, as I said earlier, it depends on the depth of the ekpyrotic potential. So it's most useful to concentrate on those regions that make it all the way down, because those are the ones that make the most structure. Now, another parameter that determines the amplitude is the steepness of the potential, which is characterized here by epsilon, which is the equation of state. So there are no strong arguments for what value epsilon should take. So what I'm going to do here is assume epsilon takes the value of about 100, which then corresponds to having a spectral tilt that deviates from unity, sorry, a spectral index that deviates from unity by about 1%. Otherwise, you can also keep it arbitrary, and then there will be a correlation between the value of epsilon and the value of Q. Another thing that the depth of the potential determines is the speed of the collision. So you can imagine that the scalar field rolls down the potential, and then the brains collide. But if the scalar field rolls further down the potential, it will gain more speed, and this corresponds to the brains colliding faster. And so the depth of the potential determines both the amplitude of the perturbation as well as the speed of collision. You can combine these relations to find that Q is roughly given by the speed of collision divided by the initial brain separation. Now, in this context of that I'm talking about, this which is the context of Hojava-Witten theory, we know roughly what this brain separation should be at the current time in order to reproduce both Newton's constant and the inferred coupling constant at ground unification. And there's a certain value, so this brain separation should be about 10 to the 3.5 in reduced Planck units. So I'm just going to take that value. Again, if you don't want to impose that value, you can leave it arbitrary and then find a correlation between its number and the other quantities. Now, as I said earlier, the amount of particle production you get at the brain collision depends on the collision velocity. And so Neil and Paul and Malcolm Perry have shown that if, as long as this brain collision velocity is non-relativistic, you get a sort of reasonably small amount of particle productions. As soon as it becomes relativistic, you actually produce so many particles at the brain collision that the universe immediately overcloses and recollapses. So in the higher dimensional point of view, this would correspond to the brains actually just sticking together. And so on those grounds, there is a bound on how large the collision velocity can be. And if we take, so we can take that bound to be roughly given by roughly 10% of the speed of light. And this immediately then implies a bound on the amplitude of density perturbations, which comes out as about 10 to the minus 4.5. Bearing in mind that I've put in that the spectral index should deviate by on the percent level from unity. So in that sense, if I put all these parameters back in that I left out, what it really means is that in this model, there is a correlation between these parameters, the amplitude of perturbations, the spectral index, the value of Newton's constant, and the gauge coupling at grand unification. So there is a strong correlation between completely different kinds of cosmological observables. And moreover, because you're in this is the region that makes it, moreover, you can, this is a region which you expect to be spatially extremely flat. So this is also correlated with the universe being flat, and it is correlated with certain values of the non-Gaussianity parameters in the CMB. So in that sense, this combination of having this selection effect and amplification, this allows for the model to be extremely predictive in imposing these kinds of correlations. Okay, and that's essentially what I wanted to say. So I think there's these two features that really that are really central to the model. One is that the Hubble rate during the smoothing phase is so low, and the other one is that you select out flat regions of the universe. So not only do you have a phase which makes the universe flat, but those regions that do not become flat actually become extremely highly curved. So you sort of separate the universe into clearly separated regions. And I've shown you one application of this, which is to try and understand the amplitude of primordial perturbations. And, well, I think it will be interesting to see if one can study the model further to find other such correlations. Thank you.
Thanks. Your selection criteria assumes that when something totally gravitationally collapses, a region gravitationally collapses, it's done for. But, serious versions of quantum gravity, when they follow the gravitational collapse through the strongly quantum gravity regions, show that there are bounces. And do you have to assume that that's not true and that singularities are final?
So here I'm assuming that those regions that are gravitationally collapsed, that they essentially stay that way for a long time. That these regions do not grow again immediately. So I'm assuming that.
Yeah. Okay. So if bounces are generic in quantum gravity, then you have a problem with your selection criteria.
Yeah. Then one has to extend the model. That's right. One has to rethink it. That's true.
I don't know very much about this Eck product stuff, but you say that the flatness, the homogeneity of the universe is produced during the contracting phase.
Yeah, it's both during the dark energy phase and during the contracting ekperiotic phase.
Yeah, so is there a controlled situation where you can see that whatever happens when it all turns around doesn't produce inhomogeneities? It seems like the universe all rushes together and then there's some scattering process that happens. And I just don't know. Is it clear that that won't undo the homogeneity?
Right. So the ekperiotic phase lasts until very shortly before the brain collision. So the universe becomes exponentially flat. In the sense that In fact, in these models, there's a dark energy phase that typically lasts about 60 eV, and then there's an ekprotic phase which lasts the equivalent of 120 eV. So it's a similar flattening effect as having 180 eV of inflation. What I described is that the brain collision, at the brain collision, I'm relying on these semi-classical calculations that show that this seems to be fine, right? That there is no, that you don't produce curvatures. So the thing is that because the curvature is so small, you also automatically suppress all curvature corrections at the brain collision. And that's an indication that these semi-classical studies may be accurate.
I just want to take issue with the notion that there's such a thing as a mild measure problem or a little bit of eternal inflation. It's like with pregnancy. I mean, there's no, you know, once you have the infinities, you need to introduce the cutoff. And once you introduce the cutoff, that cutoff can have incredibly strong effects on the predictions that you make. That's why I don't understand how you can say that you make any predictions without specifying it. For example, it's enough just to require that, and any model better should have that, namely just standard cosmology. It has to fit in there somewhere, what we actually see. If you use a proper time cutoff, you predict that we should live very early in that cosmology, in the hot early universe. It doesn't matter what the rest of your model is, if it has 10 to the 500 other vacua or one other vacuum. That's a huge effect that comes from the way that you pick the cutoff. There is no cutoff that I'm aware of that has been proposed that does not have such consequences. So it's just that the fact that you're getting rid of infinities will have effects. It doesn't matter what model you work in.
All right, so the general features of the universe that are produced here after each brain collision are the same each time. So I don't... Right, so instead of, for example, so what you can take a different approach. Instead of talking about measures, you can just say that there are strong correlations between different parameters, different cosmological observables. And then if you're willing to input some of these, you get predictions for the others. And that's, I think that is also a very valid prediction. So I think that remains to be explored, right?
Okay, I think we'll thank Jean-Luc.